Case number 24-7101. Geoffrey Hansen et al. Appellants versus Islamic Republic of Iran, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Mr. Perlis for the appellants, Ms. Orgel for the pony and Ms. Curia.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning,
Mr. Perlis, please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Judge Katsas, Judge Srinivasan, Judge Randolph. May it please the court. I'm Joshua Perlis, counsel for all plaintiffs' appellants. Excuse me, let me adjust the lectern here. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The fundamental question in this case is whether the Al-Assad missile attack was an extrajudicial killing. As this court held in Borishov, the word killing in the TVPA and consequently in section 1605A of the FSA carries its ordinary meaning, that is, an action resulting in the death of another. The missile attack resulted in the death of Jason Katugra. It was a killing. If the attack was also deliberated, not previously authorized.
There surely is a causal connection embedded in the word killing, but I'm not sure killing equates to any wrongful act that proximately causes a death. It seems to be narrower.
I'm not certain we agree, Your Honor.
I mean, just looking at how treatment of homicide in criminal law, the state of tort law in 1991 when the TVPA was passed, neither of those background bodies of law would pick up this kind of fact pattern. And, you know, you could call that a general proximate cause principle, or you could call it a limitation embedded in the word killing.
I believe this court in KEFV versus Iran instructed that in analyzing the, I believe Judge Randolph, I believe you're on that panel, that judges should look to the face of the FSIA where the language is clear, rather than looking to background principles or common law principles. And the definition of an extrajudicial killing is a killing that is deliberated and not previously authorized by a regularly constituted court. The definition of the word killing is an act that results in the death of another.
Right, but I can stare at that word on the page all day, and I'm not going to have a great sense of how attenuated it is too attenuated, which is why I'm defaulting back to criminal and tort concepts.
Proximate causation, I think, has proved itself to be a really good analytical tool for complex fact patterns, not just in the FSI context, but in other tort contexts. And it's very good at distinguishing between causes that are simply too attenuated from the result. Here, if you look at the report of Dr. Che, Iran detonated 3.5-ton explosive devices within meters of Jason Katugra. It physically altered the structure of his brain. It caused microscopic damage to tissue throughout his brain. That's been shown to cause impulsivity, difficulty with impulse control, changes to cognitive function. And it's statistically linked to suicide.
Can I ask a question, maybe to tease it out a little bit? Which is, I think, along the same lines. So, I mean, tragic facts, horrifying. But if we take what you just said, that the bombing exacerbated some conditions in the way that you just described, but the third part was it leads to the suicide. But instead of leading to a suicide, it exacerbates stressors. It does some things that might well be predictable given the nature of the course of events. But what it does is causes the person to engage in an act of violence that causes the death of other people. And you can trace it causally to the bombing, that it resulted in PTSD. It exacerbates conditions that might bring about a somewhat, predictable in the sense that it's not entirely unforeseeable. And what that person ends up doing is acting out in a violent way that kills other people. Would that, it's still causally connected. It's still death that results from the initial act,
I think it would be the responsibility of the fact finder to use proximate causation to determine whether that's too attenuated. And again, just to be precise, Your Honor, Dr. Shea's report didn't say that Jason Katuga's previously existing conditions were exacerbated by the attack. Right. They were caused by the attack.
And I'll follow that all the way through. I mean, I think you can imagine a parallel scenario in which the ultimate result is not the taking of one's own life, but it's the taking of somebody else's life.
It's certainly a possibility. It's theoretically possible. But again, the fact that that possibility exists does not absolve the district court of its obligation to carry out causal analysis under proximate cause. And I think a district court could very well determine that yet another step is too attenuated for proximate cause.
But it could determine the opposite, too. In other words, I'm just trying to figure out your theory wouldn't cordon that off. It would leave it up to, it would require a fact finder to make a determination.
Yeah, and I think the district court in other cases, in a lot of the FSIA cases, and Lee in particular, looks at, so these are folks who, other people were killed in their attack. The court took subject matter jurisdiction over their injuries, their traumatic brain injuries. And the question was, what part of that brain injury is compensable? What is the measure of damages? And the court baked into the damages figure, which was $3 to $7 million per incident of traumatic brain injury, mild traumatic brain injury, the risk of suicidality and homicidality. So the district court looked at that, said, yeah, there's a risk that down the line, these folks will ruin their lives through acts of violence, and that is compensable. It, based on an expert report very similar to Dr. Shea's, was able to reach that conclusion. So yes, I'd say it is theoretically possible. And just the district court judge would have to look at the totality of the facts to determine whether or not that killing was too causally attenuated.
So homicidality and suicidality. Homicidality, I guess, just to make sure I understand the terminology, homicidality would be the kind of scenario that I outlined.
Yes.
And suicidality would be what?
We have another case, Burks versus the Islamic Republic of Iran. That was someone who survived at a TBI, and his personality changed dramatically. And the court chose to compensate him for changes to his choices. He made bad choices in his life. He had poor interactions with police. He was shot in an interaction with police, and the court found that and other issues he would face in the future are causally related to the traumatic brain injury. If Iran breaks the tool, the organ of the body that people use to generate intent to make choices, it should be responsible for the resulting harms. The same way that if it damaged the tool we use to pump blood through our bodies and someone succumbs to that injury days or weeks or months or years later, Iran is still responsible, and it certainly falls within the subject matter jurisdiction of this court.
If we have the homicidality scenario, then the extrajudicial killing, the killing is not of the person who was the target of the attack, right? But it would still...
Again, theoretically possible, not the question before bar, obviously. Yeah, and again, I think the district court is particularly... The District Court for the District of Columbia has shown itself extremely adept at evaluating the connection between an attack and the resulting harms or material support. It's very good at looking at the passage of time, at the magnitude of, in terms of material support, the magnitude of material support offered. I don't find the possibility that a court would have to engage in that analysis to weed out homicidality, for example, to be particularly alarming or particularly challenging from an administration perspective.
If this just reduces to a fact question, approximate cause for the district court, how does that help you? I mean, there's been a presentation of as much evidence as there's going to be, and the district court has ruled against your clients. A lot of her analysis sounds in proximate cause. Would you say that an adverse proximate cause ruling would be reversible for clear error? Ruling of no proximate cause on these facts?
The judge's analysis, respectfully, did not approach proximate causation analysis. And The judge cited Dr. Che's report approvingly on multiple occasions.
I mean, formally she rested on killing, but some of the analysis sounds in proximate cause. She said this wasn't sufficiently foreseeable. I mean, what do we do?
I do not believe that the district court found that it was insufficiently foreseeable. In fact, the district court credited Dr. Che's report, where he found that Jason Kaduga's death was a foreseeable result of the attack and said simply, that's not dispositive, which is true. It's not dispositive. An additional element required is substantial relation. Instead of engaging in that inquiry as to whether the attack was substantially related to Jason Kaduga's death, the district court said plaintiffs were unable to prove that it was the only cause of the attack, which is clearly not the standard. That's an impossible standard. There's no terrorist attack that doesn't involve some choice by the victim or a third party to go back in the building. In the case of a massive attack, you know, first responders apply triage. There's all sorts of choices. It's an impossible standard to meet. The district court affirmatively said that plaintiffs did not provide evidence that the attack was that Jason's death was a foreseeable and natural result of the attack. That affirmative statement is simply incorrect. The district court didn't simply overlook the evidence, didn't overlook the finding of Dr. Che, who again found it foreseeable and who found it explicitly a substantial cause in his death. It denied that this evidence existed after citing it elsewhere in its opinion. So it cited it for its proposition that the attack was foreseeable. It cited it for the proposition that there were other causes, such as Jason Kaduga having to return to duty to cover the duties of his fellow service members who were injured in the same attack. But it was, again, it was error under any standard to say that plaintiffs have not provided evidence that the attack was that Jason's death was a foreseeable and natural result of the attack.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions at this time. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Thomas Burge from the University of Georgia. Today I have two students with me, Eli Werbel and Elijah Eccles. And Eli will be presenting argument on our behalf, and I'll be at council table. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. It's horrible.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Eli Werbel. Under the Federal Sovereign Immunity Act's terrorism exception, an extrajudicial killing has three elements: a killing that is deliberated and extrajudicial. The district court correctly found that the first two elements are not present in this case, and it therefore lacked subject matter jurisdiction. Should this court disagree, it should remand for consideration of the third element, whether Iran's actions were extrajudicial. I'll take each element in turn, beginning with the first. Sergeant Kaduga's death was not a killing, and that's because an uncoerced suicide is categorically excluded from the plain meaning and ordinary language of the word killing under the terrorism exception. As a plaintiff agrees, this court in Barakov explained that a killing carries its ordinary meaning, which is an act resulting in the death of another.
Act resulting in the death of another. Resulting in just sounds like shorthand for some sort of causal chain that's tight enough, just proximate cause.
That's true, Your Honor. My understanding of the categorical rule is simply that suicide in underlying principles of law is commonly understood to be an intervening cause.
Maybe, but the hardest thing on your side of the case is the third restatement of torts, which has a hypothetical of someone plants the bomb and a random bystander is badly injured and later commits suicide. And that causal chain supports a tort claim, an intentional tort claim. That cause is tight enough. And the terrorism exception is a gateway for things that look like tort claims.
Congress didn't use the term wrongful killing or intentional tort. Congress used the narrower term killing in this case. And a killing comes from criminal law. And so it makes sense in this case to look towards criminal law. For example, the Model Penal Code, Section 210.5.
The criminal law is on your side, but one could, I was wondering, what's the better analogy? I get that killing sort of sounds in criminal law, and that's helpful for you. But again, these are civil claims for damages recovered. No one's being criminally prosecuted here.
There are civil claims, but a killing is a criminal action that may result in liability and tort. That's true in wrongful death cases, in survival actions, and it's true in this case. Congress easily could have written an act causing wrongful death. In that case, a foreign state could be liable, and they didn't do so. Congress chose to use that narrower term, killing, which carries a criminal law definition. And in the background is this principle of narrow construction. This court in Borokov explained that when there's any ambiguity in the statute, the tiebreaker should be in favor of the foreign sovereign.
Are there any criminal statutes that use the word killing?
Yes, I believe the federal murder statute.
Are there? Okay.
Uses the word killing, and Congress did not specifically define the word killing to exclude suicide, but courts have defined the word killing in that manner. I'd also like to respond to some of the cases, Burks and some of the other ones that the plaintiff mentioned, where people, foreign states were held liable for suicides. Those were personal injuries caused by an act of extrajudicial killing, not the killing itself. In those cases, there was already a separate act that satisfied the predicate act of extrajudicial killing, and then a suicide could be compensated for damages and pain and suffering and the like.
What's the scenario in which, in your view, a death that results by suicide would fit within the statute?
That would be if the death is coerced, or under the Model Penal Code's definition, if it is induced by fraud, duress, or deception. For example, the 10th Circuit had a case where Cuba credibly threatened to kill the deceased, his wife, and his children if he did not take his own life.
So is that even a suicide?
I would call that a coerced suicide, which is a killing. And that tracks with the Model Penal Code's definition and also with tort law as well.
Under the Model Penal Code, a coerced suicide, there is a thing called a coerced suicide.
The Model Penal Code uses the words force, duress, and deception, but I would categorize that in the same general category as a coerced suicide.
And they use force, duress, and what was the last one you said?
Deception.
Deception, in connection with the word suicide.
Yes. And on the other hand, in the case of Haman versus Iran, which is a D.C. District Court case, the Houthis killed a United States citizen, and the court suggested that had the citizen died by suicide rather than homicide, there would not have been an extrajudicial killing. So other cases track this same principle, not using the word coerced, but it's a generally accepted legal standard. Your Honor, to the extent—
Coerced is a pretty open-ended concept. I mean, you suffer a traumatic brain injury and your life is completely messed up. And, you know, who knows what the biochemistry is that causes or doesn't cause the victim to take his own life at that point.
So the implication behind the word coerced is that the deceased volition would be impaired, or in tort terminology, that there would have been an irresistible impulse to take one's own life, and that it was not a voluntary act. And that's what, if a suicide is coerced, then the act would not have been voluntary, it would not have been an intervening act. And so that makes sense. In this case, we don't even have to get to the definition of coerced, because Dr. Che's report does not analyze Sergeant Quatuga's volition in any way. There is no claim by the plaintiffs that his volition was impaired, that the act of suicide was not a voluntary act in this case. If this court chooses to take a proximate cause test, there's still insufficient evidence in this case to create the proximate cause chain. It is simply too attenuated. Dr. Che in his report failed to review any medical records from the 19 months preceding the suicide or any medical records predating Iran's attack. He did not speak with Sergeant Quattugua or his family. He only reviewed summaries of the interviews with the families. And he included intervening causes aside from the suicide itself, like Sergeant Quattugua's early return to work against doctor's orders. So in this case, the causal chain is simply too attenuated, even if this court does not follow the categorical rule for suicide.
But if there's not a categorical rule, I mean, your first order submission is a categorical rule for suicide. But if there's not, then there's nothing about this fact pattern that necessarily takes it outside the can of proximate causation. You're just saying that based on what's exactly in the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
It falls short. But the same sequence of events could be within the fold of proximate causation.
Additional evidence would be required to create that causal chain, but it's not impossible. With my remaining time, if there's no further questions, I'd like to turn to the next two issues. The second element is deliberation. And the district court correctly held that a death must result in a manner or a manner similar to that which a foreign state intended in order to be deliberated. In this case, there's no evidence in the record that Iran intended for service members to take their own lives. That's simply not present in the record. There's no evidence.
I don't see how this gets you anywhere. If you lose on proximate cause, Iran intended to kill these people. They dropped 3,000-pound bombs and... on my hypothetical, that caused the death. And their intent is as bad as can be.
Even if this court takes a broader view and just says there must be some intent to kill, not specific intent to cause a suicide, the plaintiffs have the burden of production, and their expert report contains good reasoning as to why Iran did not intend for any killings to occur. Iran specifically stated that they were attempting to...
The Supreme Leader and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying this was intentional. They intended to kill people.
Your Honor, I don't believe the Supreme Leader says that there was intent to kill. He promised to exact revenge for the death of Major General Soleimani that the United States had just committed. And in response, Iran did not want to escalate the situation, but simply to respond.
It's very hard to say that the dropping of a bomb in an area in which members are present somehow can't be undergirded by an intent to kill. That almost seems impossible.
Well, we don't need to imply an intent to kill here. In the record, there is evidence that there was no intent to kill. And that
people can say stuff about not intending to kill, but if their act is to drop a bomb on a population, it just seems exceedingly difficult. I'm not saying that under the first part of your argument, there's not something to the submission that the chain of causation wouldn't work. But if you get past that, it seems tough.
Respectfully, I disagree. And I think Iran's advance warning to the United States further underscores the fact that they did not intend to kill anyone. Otherwise, why would they provide this advance warning as admitted by the plaintiffs in the record?
I mean, I think if you don't intend to kill someone, you don't drop a bomb. That's the way you do it. I don't know that... A warning of the kind, even that doesn't say specifically, you know, when, where, and how, just seems tough. But that's fallback. I think it's pretty clearly under your view of fallback.
I understand that. The difficulties with this interpretation, but the plaintiffs have the burden of production here, and they submitted evidence to the contrary that there was only an intent to harm military structures, not cause fatalities. And to the extent the court disagrees with the previous arguments, it should remand for a consideration of whether this was an extrajudicial killing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your arguments. Ms. Werbel, Mr. Perlis, we'll give you the 2 minutes that you asked for a rebuttal.
Before you begin, I just noticed that in this list of individuals in your brief, first page, the individual we're talking about here is not listed. Why is that?
Is Your Honor referring to the caption?
Yeah.
They're listed in the complaint, and the instruction received from the clerk's office at the district court was because of the mechanical difficulties of entering simultaneously.
How do you pronounce the individual we're talking about that committed?
Sergeant Jason, and I believe the pronunciation is Katugwa, and it's spelled Quit Ugwa, but I believe it's Katugwa.
He's not listed.
He is not in the caption. In the caption, Your Honor. He is listed.
The complaint is not in the appendices. Is he a plaintiff in this case?
He is. His estate is a plaintiff. His mother is a plaintiff. His siblings are plaintiffs.
In the complaint.
In the complaint. And apologies, Your Honor, for the caption. But again, we were advised by the district court's clerk that because of the mechanical limitations on the number of plaintiffs you can enter simultaneously, that the controlling list of...
It seems to me odd that, you know, the whole... All the argument in the brief is about this one individual, and he's not even listed in the caption.
Again, I apologize for that, Your Honor. He's definitely a plaintiff. He's definitely listed in the complaint. And if I could redesign ECF, I certainly would.
Okay.
I'd like to turn first to this idea of a categorical exclusion. Again, the district court cites Wackenhut, which is opinion of this circuit, and D.C. versus Peters, which is a D.C. Court of Appeals case. Both of those rely on the Section 455 of the Second Restatement of Torts, which is acts done during insanity caused by negligent conduct. And it basically, the idea is that in a negligence case, unless the malfeasance causes an uncontrollable urge, there's a causal interruption or an uncontrollable urge for suicide. Again, taking that at face value, I think there is evidence that an uncontrollable urge is created. Dr. Che describes the effect of TBI on impulsivity and on cognition, and it fundamentally affected the way Jason Katugwa's brain worked. So even taking face value, which this court should not, that standard is satisfied. Second of all, as Your Honor's alluded to, the third restatement holds bad actors responsible for suicides. They're approximately caused by their intentional acts. Again, the second illustration is very similar to the facts at bar. And perhaps most importantly, I'm not certain that the common law applies in the procedural posture of this case. Again, the question before this court is whether or not it has subject matter jurisdiction over plaintiffs' claims, not whether they have remedies in the common law or what their measure of damages is. If you look at KEFV versus Iran, the court there very quickly in a couple, you know, maybe a paragraph of text disposed of the question as to whether there was subject matter jurisdiction liability. The question there was whether an individual born a few months after their parent died had claims under the FSIA. And the court went through the list, parent was killed, immediate family member, Iran on the state-sponsored terrorism list, claim for money damages, et cetera, and says, look, we've disposed of subject matter jurisdictional liability. Then it looks to the common law to determine whether the private right of action created by Section 1605A, which does this court has found and the district court has found, looks to the common law. In determining whether they could recover damages, then looked to the common law. Here, the question is whether or not the court has subject matter jurisdiction. And as this court admonished in KFV, courts should not search outside the FSIA when the relevant law is the statute's plain text. To find that text is to find the law. So I'm not certain. Again, I think we meet more than meet that exception with the evidence on record. The third restatement makes clear that it doesn't apply. Again, both Wackenhut and Peters are negligence cases, not intentional torts. And in this procedural posture, I don't think the common law doesn't determine the subject matter jurisdiction of this court. It cannot be that the definition of killing is different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Okay.
Regarding the quality of Dr. Che's, or the notion that Dr. Che's report does not analyze.
This is on Dr. Che's definition. Okay, is the last point, then please just.
I'm sorry, okay.
Yep.
I'll Thank you. This will be my last point. Dr. Tay's report does analyze volition. It specifically talks about how TBI affects the ability of service members to control their impulses, such as suicide. And he says specifically that this is what happened to Dr. Shea. So it's not correct that he did not take that into account in his report. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. Ms. Werbel, you and your team were appointed by the court to present arguments supporting the appellees in this matter, and the court thanks you for your able assistance.
Yeah.
Take this case under submission.
Thank you.